Father in heaven, thank you for bringing us here together today, and thank you for this time that can be set aside to learn more about how to have true meaning in our lives through you. So bless our thoughts and our discussions today. In your name I pray. Amen. So I started reading a new book fairly recently. It was around the same time that I started thinking about this talk, and it's a book by the journalist, the New York Times journalist David Brooks, and he's got this new book out called The Second Mountain, The Quest for a Moral Life. And I haven't finished the book yet, but I would highly recommend it to any of you. I think David Brooks is a great author, this is just turning out to be a really good book, and it really coincided with some of the things that I had been thinking about talking about with you this morning. And so I'm actually going to use it as sort of a framework for some of the things that I'm going to talk about. And so I want to start just by actually reading to you the opening couple of paragraphs from this book. David Brooks says, as he opens up this book, he says, "Every once in a while I meet a person who radiates joy. These are people who seem to glow with an inner light. They are kind, tranquil, delighted by small pleasures, and grateful for the large ones. These people are not perfect. They get exhausted and stressed. They make errors in judgment, but they live for others and not for themselves. They've made unshakable commitments to family, a cause, a community, or a faith. They know why they were put on this earth, and they derive a deep satisfaction from doing what they have been called to do. Life isn't easy for these people. They've taken on the burdens of others, but they have a serenity about them, a settled resolve, and they're interested in you. They make you feel cherished and known. They take delight in your good. When you meet these people, you realize that joy is not just a feeling. It can be an outlook. There are temporary highs that we all get after we win some victory, and then there is also this other kind of permanent joy that animates people who are not obsessed with themselves, but have given themselves away." Have you ever known somebody like that in your life? Somebody who doesn't seem to be fazed by the trials of their everyday life, but they just sort of emanate this experience of joy? I've known a few people in my life like that, and when I think about them, the people that I know who are like that are some of the most inspirational people that I can think of in my life. In this book, Brooks goes on to talk about these individuals, and he sort of uses this metaphor of mountains. And he says that these individuals who emanate this sort of special joy in their lives have traversed what Brooks calls the second mountain. They realize that the first mountain that we all tend to climb, it's this mountain that we climb when we're trying to accomplish things that the world around us tells us that we ought to accomplish in order to be happy with our lives. That's what he calls the first mountain. This is all about personal accomplishments, our attempts to make ourselves feel satisfied, figuring out our personal identity, cultivating our talents, building up our ego, securing our own place in the world, obtaining academic or work success, whatever it is that we think is going to fulfill us in life. He says that these are the normal goals that culture tells us is important to be successful, to be well thought of, to get invited into the right social circles. And he proposes that the world tells us that thinking about these things should lead us to personal happiness. But then oftentimes for some people, as they're pursuing those goals, something happens, and they realize that this can't be all that life has to offer. They sense that there must be a deeper journey that we can all take. For some people, it results from some failure that they experienced, right? Some maybe something knocked them off their feet. Maybe it was a career failure, or maybe it was a significant loss that they experienced in their lives, something that just threw them totally off kilter. For some people, it might have been going through sickness or a cancer scare. For some people, they're lucky enough to not have to go through something like that, but they just realize that there has to be something more than that first mountain, and they seek some bigger sense of fulfillment. And they start to climb the second mountain, the bigger mountain, one that is not about the happiness that comes in the pursual of self-interest, but it's about the larger joy that comes with finding meaning in one's life through self-sacrifice. through relationships, through connections with mankind. And these people accomplish what I'm going to refer to as the second mountain happiness in their lives. They're special individuals. They're unique. There's something about them that is unusual because not many of us are able to accomplish this second mountain type of happiness. In fact, most of us don't experience life satisfaction in the way that we desire it at all. Most statistics tell us that the majority of us are not all that happy with our lives. Does anybody know what is significant about the date March 20th? I asked my wife that, and she was like, yeah. Well, I had already thought about one reason that March 20th is significant for us. Her birthday, my wife Christy's birthday, is March 19th. So March 20th is the day after my wife's birthday. She also told me that it is the International Social Worker Day. She's a social worker. She's a professor of social work at Southern. But what I learned through my studies this week is that March 20th is also the UN's Day of International Happiness. It's the International Day of Happiness. It's a day to be happy. And I guess it didn't really surprise me that the day after my wife's birthday was the day to be happy, right? Day to celebrate. So since 2013, the United Nations has celebrated the International Day of Happiness as a way to recognize the importance of happiness in the lives of people throughout the world. To coincide with this year's International Day of Happiness, Gallup released its 8th annual World Happiness Report. And this report, which has been released every year since 2012, surveyed 156 countries using a variety of metrics related to overall well-being. And despite having one of the strongest economies that we've experienced in years, despite having low crime rates, despite having low levels of unemployment, the U.S. actually dropped in its happiness rankings for the third year in a row. This was America's worst showing ever. Although we've never made it into the top 10, now we are ranked 19th happiest country in the world, just behind Belgium. And Jimmy Kimmel commented on this the day after this report came out, and he said, yep, we're right behind Belgium, the people who feel the need to put mayonnaise on their French fries. And I was like, yeah, that stuff's gross. He said, yeah, that's nasty, right? Kimmel was like, cheer up, everybody. Cheer up, Americans. But the solution isn't that simple for most of us Americans. Even though most indicators of a satisfactory quality of life have gone up for Americans over the past half century, and we should be happier than we ever have been before, we are less happy than we've ever been. We've experienced tremendous economic growth, but we've experienced virtually no boost to morale. We've excelled at making a living, but we have failed to make a life. We can celebrate our prosperity, but we are yearning for a purpose. We cherish our freedoms, but we're longing for connection. You may have noticed the seeming decline in happiness in those around you. I teach at Southern, like Mike mentioned, and I've noticed, I've only taught there for 6 years. This is my 6th year of teaching at Southern Adventist University, but I can tell you without a doubt that I have noticed that the students at Southern seem to be experiencing more stress, more anxiety, more depression, and less happiness in their lives, even in just that small period of time that I've been there. In fact, just this year, I've had more students have to spend time with significant mental health care, seeing counselors, going to psychiatric hospitals than I have ever experienced during my time there. For whatever reason, something's happening in our lives that we're just not experiencing true happiness. Why are we not happier, even when all indicators seem to be pointing to the fact that we should be? Researchers and psychologists indicate that there are several possibilities for the seeming decline in happiness in Americans' lives. And so I want to talk about a few of those with you today. One of them, maybe the most prominent one from research, says that we seem to be experiencing in America an epidemic of addictions that seems to be plaguing our society. This can include everything from substance abuse and gambling to increased use of social media and participation in risky sexual behaviors. We have become a mass addiction society. We're either addicted to opioids, sex and pornography, or our devices. And I think we can all identify with one of those, at least this one, for all of us. If you don't identify your addiction with this thing right here, try leaving it at home for a day and see how you feel. You will probably feel more anxious than you ever have in the past weeks. I have this little kind of ritual that we do in the mornings. Our kids usually wake us up about 6 o'clock, if we're lucky. It seems like these days, if we're lucky, they make it till 6 o'clock, and then they come downstairs, they wake us up. My wife gets up, she goes upstairs, starts making breakfast or something. My job is to make the coffee in our house, and so if you know anything about me, you know that making coffee in the Wild household does not just mean pushing, you know, start on the Mr. Coffee. It's a ritual, so we have to fill the kettle up with water and put it on, and then we have to grind the beans, and then we have to get the grinds and pour them in the Chemex, and then it takes exactly 4 minutes to pour the water over the Chemex so that the coffee tastes perfect afterwards. And so what I do is during that 4 minutes, I take out my phone and I tell my wife, it's to start the timer for the 4 minutes, and I'm here waiting for the coffee to brew, and I'm, you know, browsing through my phone. I'm engaged in, you know, checking out the news and seeing what all my friends are up to on Instagram, and my kids might be talking to me, but I'm too busy seeing what's going on in the day, right? And my kids are like, Dad, 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 and I don't hear them. And Chrissy's like, finally, like, Tron, do you not hear the kids? They're talking to you. Can you respond to them? And I'm too busy checking out what's going on with the day. We're all addicted to these things. I looked up the numbers of the amount of hours we spend on these things, and I was thrown off. I was actually really surprised. The numbers are staggering. The average 17 or 18-year-old spends more than 6 hours a day in leisure time on the internet, social media, and texting. 6 hours a day. And our work has changed in such a way that the average adult now spends the majority of their waking hours staring at a screen. Americans spend more time than ever watching videos, browsing social media, and swiping their lives away on tablets and smartphones. We spend more than 11 hours a day staring at a screen in some form or fashion. And all this screen time, researchers have found, has been linked specifically to increases in depression and decreases in other activities in our life that brings us satisfaction. We're spending less time sleeping. We're spending less time hanging out with other people, sharing meals with each other, engaging in face-to-face interactions. We are engrossed in our phones and our media, and we're not engrossed in each other. Another possibility for the decline in happiness, according to researchers, has to do with the way that our brains process the experience of happiness. The experience of happiness, the way that we normally think of it, that sort of first mountain happiness that I'm sort of talking about, is a fleeting sense of happiness, right? It's something that we experience in a moment, and we think it's going to give us this long-term satisfaction, but then it's gone. I'll give you an example. We've all started a phrase with, won't it be great when I finish this degree and then I can live my life? Wouldn't it be great when I get that promotion and I really start making some money and then I can really be happy? Wouldn't it be great when I just get through this project and then I can start doing it? I say these things to myself all the time. Wouldn't it be great when my kids are old enough to kind of take care of themselves and then I can like start fulfilling my needs again? Wouldn't it be great when I fall in love? Wouldn't it be great when? Wouldn't it be great when? Similarly, we oftentimes hear older people in our lives say, wasn't it great when, you know, back in the day, that's when the good old days were. We need to get back to times when I was younger, when things were truly great. But how oftentimes do we hear people saying, isn't this great right now? That's not a phrase that we hear too often. Surely our past and future aren't always better than the present. Yet we continue to think this is the case. Let's even think about it from a theological perspective. We're either looking back to the beginning when times were perfect in the Garden of Eden, or we're looking forward to the unfathomable future of happiness in heaven. Eternal happiness is always the carrot that's dangling from the end of the divine stick, and we're never realizing kind of how happy we can be in this moment. Why are we this way? Well, maybe psychologists think that this actually is a helpful thing to us. These delusions about the past and the future could be an adaptive part of our psyche as a way of motivating ourselves to get through the mundane type of present. If we know that things have been good at certain times in our lives and we are looking forward to them being good at some time in the future, then that keeps us striving and keeps us working hard to move on to the next thing. But what we know, and psychologists call this concept, call it the hedonic treadmill. It's this idea that we've been talking about, that if I work hard enough, I'm going to get to this next kind of goal in my life, and then I'm going to be happy. What we know is that we achieve that thing, and we experience this momentary sense of satisfaction, and then pretty soon we go back to our baseline of happiness, right? You've probably experienced that in your life. And so I hate to be a bummer today, but however happy you are right now in life is probably about how happy you're going to be 5 years from now, or 10 years from now, or 20 years from now. For those of you who are students in the building and are looking forward to not being students anymore and getting a job and having success, sorry to burst your bubble, but you're probably not ever going to be any happier than you are right now. That's just the way it is. But this doesn't really have to be a bad thing. I mean, perpetual bliss would completely undermine our ability to accomplish anything, right? Recognizing that happiness exists and it's a delightful visitor that never really outstays its welcome can help us appreciate it more when it actually does come our way. Another part of the problem of happiness today, and I really think this is the crux of things as we're talking with you today, is that there are different types of happiness that human beings experience. And they aren't all necessarily complementary to each other. In fact, some types of happiness can even be in conflict with one another as we're seeking to fulfillment in our lives. In other words, having too much of one type of happiness may actually undermine our ability to experience happiness in other areas of life. So it's impossible to have complete fulfillment in all areas of happiness in great quantities all at the same time. When we are focused on building a successful career or a good marriage, that means that we have to give up other parts of our lives that tend to make us happy. We have to give up, as we're working hard in pursuit of a good career, we have to give up those lazy days of just sitting around, enjoying good company, watching television and Netflix, or just hanging out at a coffee shop. No, we've got to keep our nose to the grindstone. And sometimes keeping our nose to the grindstone in seeking success in our career means that we can't spend time with the one that we're trying to cultivate a relationship with. Sometimes our different pursuits of happiness butt up against each other. In fact, one of the things that I think many of us think that will really lead to a sense of real happiness in our lives, which is having kids, is really associated significant declines in happiness. Parents, can I get an amen? No, really, the research tells us that when you have children, your happiness, your personal happiness level goes down, not up. If you don't have children, remember that. I'll give you an example. We had our first child, Ace. He is 7 now, but when we first had him, you know, we were going through, shortly after he was born, we were going through the typical times of new parents, of losing sleep, worried about keeping him fed, worried about stopping him from crying and all that stuff. My wife was home from maternity leave, so she was dealing with most of that. And then about 6 months in, you know, she needed a break. So I was like, hey, why don't you find something that you can do to just get away, and I'll just take care of Ace, you know, for a while. And so there was a concert in Knoxville, and it was actually a concert of a band that we both enjoyed. It was a band called Iron and Wine. I don't know if anybody else likes Iron and Wine, but I would have loved to have gone and seen Iron and Wine, but I was like, no, you go with your friend. I'll stay home with the baby, and I'll take care of him. So she travels up to Knoxville, and I'm taking care of Ace. And I get a text from her in the middle of that evening, and I look at the text, and it's a picture. And it's Christy and her friend out at dinner before the concert, and she's got her arm around Sam Beam, the lead singer of the band. And I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. Do you know what I was doing in that moment? I was literally cleaning poop out of a full bathtub. I'm not joking you. That's what I was doing. I would have much rather been listening to Iron and Wine that evening. Having kids does not make you more happy, people. The good news is that having kids actually does give us a type of fulfillment in our lives, but it does not lead to the kind of happiness that most of us are longing for in our day-to-day. That type of happiness that we think we should be fulfilling is usually sort of self-centered. It involves the things that we want to do, not sacrificing ourselves for some other human being that can't take care of himself. It does lead to a happiness, though, that can't be fulfilled in any other way. It leads to the fulfillment called joy that can only come from the self-sacrifice that is inevitable when raising up another human being. So it's not all bad. The type of happiness and fulfillment that we're searching for in our day-to-day lives may not actually be what we need. We might be looking for joy in all the wrong places. We may have it backwards. Let's take a look at what the Word of God has to say about this. After all, this is a sermon, not a psychology lecture. This week I Googled, I was interested to look at what are the most popular verses in the Bible. I had a sense that some of the verses that I wanted to talk about would be in that list, and sure enough they were. I was not too surprised to find that many of the top most popular verses in the Bible are ones that seem to, when taken at face value, seem to encourage this sort of self-centered, first mountain type of happiness that I've been talking about. I want to take a look at two of those verses with you today. And I know that you'll be familiar with these verses, these texts. The first one is Philippians 4:13. I can do all things through Christ, which strengthens me. The other one is Jeremiah 29:11. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans to prosper you and not to harm you, plans to give you hope and a future. I know you know those verses. I know you know those texts. You've probably seen them on tattooed on people or underneath the blackout stuff on athletes' eyes as they're going into a sporting event or on T-shirts. I would say that not only are these two of the most popular verses in the Bible, but I believe they're also two of the most misinterpreted verses in the Bible, and they're the two of the verses that have been taken out of context most often. When we look at these two verses in context, we'll actually see that they have nothing to do with our immediate happiness or our self-centered satisfaction, getting whatever it is we want out of life, or God removing us from some sort of suffering. Let's look first at Jeremiah 29:11. I know the plans I have for you, plans to prosper you, to give you hope and a future. That sounds great. Most of us look at that verse and we use it to sort of say, I want to get into this college, or I want this type of person in my life. I want this person as my significant other. I want to get this job. These are my plans, and now I'm going to sort of will them into God's plan for my life. Jeremiah 29:11 actually appears in a letter that was written by the prophet Jeremiah to the Jewish community that had been taken exiled in Babylon in 6th century BC. The letter, expressing God's comfort and judgment of the former inhabitants of Jerusalem, informs the recipients that they will return to their homeland after 70 years, because God intends to fulfill his promises to bless them. He's not saying that in the context of right now, it's all going to be better. He's saying, wait here 70 more years in exile, and then I will fulfill this promise. I have plans for you, but it's going to take a little while. You're going to go through a lot more suffering until then. Some of us, some of those people weren't even going to live for 70 more years. If I were to say to you today, if you were to think about that verse in the context of its real context, you'd be like, I don't even know if I'll live long enough for God to fulfill his plan for me in my life. We have twisted this verse to make it a promise of health and wealth for us as Christians living in modern times, when it was actually a multi-generational promise to the children of Israel. It was a promise to people who were experiencing incredible pain, more suffering than most of us will ever experience. They were mourning death, a move, a transition into enslavement, all at the same time, and yet into that context, God still spoke words of hope. Second, these weren't necessarily plans for me or you. If we do want to appropriate Jeremiah 29:11 into our lives, what it says is this is plans for us. The you in 29:11 is plural. You all, or y'all, as we say here in the South. That should be obvious because it was a letter written to a community. Yet that community had lost almost everything, but they still had each other. They still had their community. That's how often God brings his blessing to us. God does have a plan for us. Unfortunately, that plan most certainly does not involve our self-satisfied happiness. What about Philippians 4:13? I can do all things through Christ, which strengthens me. One of the most well-known New Testament verses, but it's also notoriously misused. You have, as I mentioned, you've probably memorized this verse from a young age. I myself have read this verse many times in my classes as I'm encouraging some of my college students that they can get through this. They can get through finals week. God's going to be there with them. He can get them through the stress. But is that really what Paul's meaning? Is he telling us just to believe in ourselves? Or to believe that Christ can empower us to accomplish whatever it is that we set our minds to? The answer to that is no. If we truly want to know what Philippians 4:13 means, we've got to really read it in its context. We can't just strip away all the surrounding verses and remove it from its original intent and appropriate it to the way we want it to mean in our own lives. In fact, just before Paul says, I can do all things through him which gives me strength, he shares what I think is actually the more inspiring part of this passage in Philippians 4:12. Paul says, I know what it is to be in need, and I know what it is to have plenty, and I have learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. And then that's when he follows it up with 4:13. And in the NIV translation, it actually says, I can do all this through him, which strengthened me. Paul's learned to be content through Christ, even in times of great suffering. Paul isn't telling Christians that they should dream bigger dreams. He's reminding them that they can endure a crushing feeling of defeat to those dreams when they aren't accomplished. He's not encouraging Christians to go out and conquer the world. He's reminding them that they can press on even when the world conquers them. There's meaning in both joy and in suffering. And Paul knows a little bit about suffering. And he's saying, I'm content even still because there's meaning in this suffering. He knows it's for a cause. When I read this passage and I understood it a little bit better in its context, it reminded me an awful lot of another person that I had read about who, like Paul, had endured significant suffering in their life. It reminded me of a guy named Viktor Frankl, which many of you have maybe read about as well. Frankl was a psychiatrist who in 1942, during World War II, along with his wife and his parents, were deported from Vienna to a Nazi ghetto in Czechoslovakia. His father ended up dying in that Nazi ghetto from pneumonia half a year later from the deplorable conditions. The next year, Frankl and his wife were transported to the infamous Auschwitz concentration camp, where more than a million people would eventually be murdered. He was then transferred to two additional camps, which separated him from his wife and his mother, both of whom would eventually perish. And during this ordeal, Frankl came to believe that the only way that he could survive and maintain his sanity was to hold tight to a sense of some sort of meaning and purpose in his life. It was in his suffering that he found this meaning. This meaning. He was fond of quoting Friedrich Nietzsche, who wrote, "He who has a why to live can bear almost anyhow." And for Frankl, this meaning flowed from acting as a psychiatrist and a physician to his fellow prisoners in the concentration camp, as well as from reflecting on his love for his wife, Tilly, as the following passage from his book, Man's Search for Meaning, beautifully illustrates. He said, "We stumbled on into the darkness. The accompanying guards kept shouting at us and driving us with the butts of their rifles. Hiding his mouth behind his upturned collar, the man marching next to me whispered suddenly, 'If our wives could just see us now. I do hope they are better off in their camps, and I hope they don't know what's happening to us.' That brought thoughts of my own wife to my mind. My mind clung to my wife's image, imagining it with an uncanny acuteness. I heard her answering me. I saw her smile, her frank and encouraging look. I understood how a man who has nothing left in this world may still know bliss, be it only for a brief moment, in the contemplation of his beloved." After being liberated from the Nazi concentration camps, Frankl spent his life advocating for finding meaning in one's own life as the secret to true fulfillment. Meaning brought him through the Holocaust and formed the basis for his entire approach to life. So it might seem surprising to you that Frankl also recommends the following admonition: one should not search for an abstract meaning of life. Why would Frankl warn us to not search for something that he so passionately argued was really important to satisfaction? He provides a clue in the preface of his same book where he writes, "Don't aim at success. The more you aim at it and make it a target, the more you're going to miss it. For success, like happiness, cannot be pursued. It must ensue." Frankl believes that meaning cannot be pursued as a goal in itself. It must come as a side effect of pursuing other goals. "If what you really want is to find meaning," he instructs, "then you just have to let it happen by not caring about it. Instead," he suggests, "embracing activities that connect you with something greater." When we spend our lives seeking to make ourselves happy, we do so in ways that utterly leave us unhappy. They leave us empty. We seek luxury, success, admiration, social media likes, etc., etc. Interestingly, as we've learned, research tells us that those who strive most for these things in their life are the least happy. Seeking extrinsic goals, whether it's wealth, beauty, popularity, prestige, or anything else centered on external rewards or approval, and you are most likely going to experience anxiety, depression, or other psychological ills. We become less attuned to others, less caring, and less warm when we focus on ourselves. But those who focus on intrinsic goals such as intimacy, personal growth, contributions to our community, we experience a higher quality of life. In other words, what leads to true fulfillment is not personal luxury, success, competence, but a focus on others. That question that I asked you in the beginning to talk about what was most satisfying to you over the past month, what did that cause you to experience? What need did that fulfill? That was a question that was posed by researchers, a group of academic psychologists, to a bunch of people, and they found that the top needs that most strongly accompanied that satisfying event were self-esteem, relatedness to other people, and a sense of feeling of control in one's own life. At the bottom of the list, luxuries and money. The things that we find most satisfying in our lives are typically not the things that we're seeking out in pursuit of happiness. So, I don't know what you guys said, and I'm going out on a limb here, but I'd like to see what the results were from our survey today. So let's put those up on the board. What did you say the most satisfying events in your life said? Relatedness, number one. Competence and self-actualization, autonomy. The same types of results that we found, I would imagine, at the bottom of the list were luxury and money. If only we could remember this in our day-to-day lives when we're seeking happiness. This may not actually come as a surprise to most of us, right? Wow. If I asked you, if you think that money and its associated luxuries would buy your happiness, very few of you would probably say yes. But the truth is that in our minds, for whatever reason, because of what the culture and society is telling us, there's a connection somehow that we put between wealth and happiness, materialism and happiness. Materialism in our country has surged as we pursue life, liberty, and the purchase of happiness. Materialism is up, finding meaning and purpose are down, which is probably why we are less happy than we've ever been before. There are much more things that are important to us in life than personal happiness. As Jesus calls us into discipleship, he says in Matthew 16, "Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it. But whoever loses their life for me will find it. What good will it be for someone to gain the whole world but forfeit their soul?" Jesus says, take up your cross and follow me. The cross is not a symbol of success. It is a symbol of sacrifice. Jesus is calling us away from a life of personal fulfillment and into a meaningful life of commitment to the service of others, a pursuit of that second mountain happiness. And this may mean sacrificing our immediate happiness, but the good news is that we will find meaning. We will truly experience joy, and like Paul, we can find commitment in every situation. Our musicians can come up.